Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest, Jim Cott, is one of the rare athletes to achieve greatness on the field and in his second career in the press box.
Well, the players get down to spring training so early. They've been down here for months, so the teams get overly protective with them, particularly Rondell White. I'd say that's the injury the Yankees are most concerned about.
One of the game's best broadcasters, who currently works for MLB Network, Cott spent 25 years in the big leagues, pitching in the 50s and the 80s. The Southpaw won 283 games with a 3.45 ERA, won 16 Gold Gloves, appeared in three All-Star games, and won a World Series ring with the Cardinals in 1982. In the last election, he missed the Hall of Fame by just 2 votes. Cott built a reputation as an incisive and honest commentator during a dozen years broadcasting Yankee games, a tenure recounted in his new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Yankees Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box, which is published by Triumph Books. It is such an honor to welcome Jim Cott to the Roundtable. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Ian. Nice visiting with you.
How did you get into broadcasting in the first place when your pitching career was winding down?
Well, as a lot of things happen in life, you know, you're in the right place at the right time or the right people do things for you. But during the latter years of my playing career in the late 70s, early 80s, if there was a rain delay, they didn't go to alternate programming. They usually called a player up to the booth during the game. Hard to believe that they would do that in these times. And you would visit with the local, with the announcers. And when I was with the Phillies, we had a rain delay in Chicago, and Richie Ashburn, Harry Callis sent somebody down and said, would I come up and just chat with him? And we must have chatted for half hour, 45 minutes, just telling stories. And there was a gentleman named Jody Shapiro who ran. At the time, he was with Major League Films, and then later he went on to run Home Team Sports Network in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore. And he said, you ought to think about getting into this business. And I didn't give it a second thought. But when we had the player strike in 1981, 51 days, he called and said, would you like to do some minor league games with Ralph Kiner and Warner Fusell? And actually, the first game I did was up in Rochester when Cal Ripken was still playing for Rochester. And that kind of kick-started me into my broadcast career.
Was it something that you felt an immediate knack for, or was there a learning curve for you?
Well, there's a learning curve, and I think there's always I'm always learning new things. I talk a great deal to my friend Tim McCarver. I fall back on things I learned from Dick Enberg and John Madden, so I think we're always learning. But I think what helped me was in high school, I was very active in speech class, in entering speaking contests, and then again, just by sort of a good break, I was doing a post-game interview in Minnesota back in the 60s, and the announcer, who happened to be Ray Scott, the voice of the Green Bay Packers in the football season, a very, very well-known and well-respected announcer, said to me, what do you think you'd like to do when you get done playing? And, of course, when you're 23, you think you're going to play forever. You don't give that much thought. And I just sort of casually said, well, I kind of like what you guys are doing. That seems like fun. And the next day I got a call from the ball club. The Twins got a call to contact me from a gentleman that owned and managed a 500-watt daytime station in Shakopee, Minnesota. So I ended up in the off season, and, again, those were the days when we – had to work in the off season because the contracts were not quite as big as they are today. And I did high school sports and signed on in the morning with the national anthem, everything that you would do at a small station like that. So that was good training.
You pitched just a season for the Yankees. So how did you end up coming to the Yankees at a time when the team was, you know, really incredibly compelling and winning? And
well, again, right place at right time. Having been with the Phillies and suffered a couple of minor injuries, and I just was not as effective a pitcher as I was when I first got there. And I think they were trying to find a way to move me. And I got called into an extra inning game only because I was the last man available out in San Diego. We went into extra innings, went 13 innings. I pitched the last 4 innings and ended up getting the win. And in the stands was a scout for the Yankees named Bertie Tebbets. Bertie was a former big league catcher. He's now passed away. He was also a manager. And so he sent a report into the Yankees because Rich Gossage had just been injured. Goose had injured his, I think it was his thumb. He was going on the disabled list for a while, and they had traded Sparky Lyle, and Ron Guidry had volunteered to go to the bullpen. They didn't want to do that, so they just needed kind of a warm body out there, a left-hand pitcher that they thought could throw it over the plate in the bullpen. And lo and behold, 2 days after that appearance in San Diego, I was sold to the New York Yankees there in May of 79.
I always wonder when I look at your stats, what you make of pitching in the game today, because, you know, you were incredibly versatile. You pitched a lot. And today, when we hear about injuries and stuff, players are on a very strict rotation. They're on pitch counts. They're shut down often. What is it that's changed in baseball? The pitchers weaker than they were?
Oh, no. If anything else, they're stronger, and they're probably more capable of pitching as much or more than we did. But I think it started back with the Mets and the Tom Seaver day. They had five solid starters, and they decided to go to a five-man rotation when they had Nolan Ryan and terrific Tom Terrific and Kuzman and Jim McAndrew and Gary Gentry. And a lot of teams didn't have five starters, and so they began to use five starters. And then I think they began, they being the Mets or other teams, figured that a pitcher began to lose his effectiveness after, we'll say, 100 pitches. So specialization was born out of that. I look at it, and I was thinking about it this morning, actually, because the Mets are going to go to a six-man rotation to, as they say, protect their pitchers. Well, if I were a, this is kind of a weird analogy, but if I were a dietitian, for example, and I said, look, you're really overweight. I think you only ought to eat once every 6 days. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. But if I said, you know, if you ate sensibly every day for 6 days, you know, maybe you'd begin to get your weight under control. Well, that was our approach to pitching. I threw every day. If I pitched nine innings today, I'll never forget, Tommy John was running laps in Chicago in the early 60s, and I had pitched nine innings the night before, and he saw me down in the bullpen, he just kind of, as I say, exercising or tossing the ball, and he stopped and said, what are you doing? You pitched nine innings yesterday. And I said, well, I exercise a little my arm every day, because if I don't pitch throw today, I'm going to be that much stiffer and sore tomorrow. And fast forward ahead to when he had the now known as the famous Tommy John surgery, one thing Dr. Job told him to do was to exercise his arm every day. And Tommy and I, ironically, were teammates in with the Yankees in 1979, early in 1980, and that's what we would do. We'd play catch every day. And I think if pitchers were trained, starting in the minor leagues, the way we were, you would have four-man rotations. You'd have pitchers pitching more complete games. You'd have more Dallas Keuchels, who were not intent on throwing 98 miles an hour, but could make the ball move and change speeds and get their off-speed pitches over the plate. And I think here tonight I'm supposed to do a game, if it doesn't rain, Cubs-Cardinals, and Jake Arrieta's going to pitch. He was a hard thrower with Baltimore. Didn't work out. They got rid of him. Learned to throw his other pitches over the plate, make the ball move. Now he's one of the best pitchers in the National League, and I think there's a lot more pitchers that could be like that.
We're speaking with the great Jim Cott. He's the author of If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Yankees Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. I want to ask you a couple more questions about broadcasting a game. You've worked with a bunch of different partners over your career. What makes the chemistry work in a booth?
Well, I think the more, like right now with Bob Costas, we're in our seventh year. We're very comfortable with one another. It's I think the ideal pairing is when you have two fellows that are just talking baseball. Kenny Singleton and I were privileged to do that for a half a dozen or so years with the Madison Square Garden Network. And, I mean, there's a gift as far as a play-by-play announcer, particularly on radio. I think you have to be a much more skillful announcer to do a game on radio like Vin Scully does. Television, you know, it doesn't take a lot of talent to say ground ball to short and throws to first, one out. But a guy like Bob Costas and other play-by-play guys can can tell you who and what about the player, some biographical information, and of course Bob has a great sense of baseball history, and I'm there to do the how and why as a former player. You know, why is a pitcher doing this, or what's the manager thinking, and why is that happening on the field? So it's a combination of those two things. But I think to the viewer, if he can get the feeling that there's just two guys there talking baseball and making it more enjoyable for them to watch and to listen, that would be the ideal telecast.
How did you get so good at fielding your position? Because when we watch the game today, a lot of pitchers, you know, they're not helping the defense's cause too much out there.
Well, when I was a young boy growing up in Michigan, my dad was a Philadelphia Athletics fan. This was the late 40s, early 50s, and the Philadelphia Athletics had a left-hand pitcher named Bobby Shantz, who I think many will still say might be the best fielder of all time. He was a great athlete, Olympic caliber diver, and he was only 5'7", and I was a little guy growing up in Michigan. I was the littlest kid in my littlest athlete really in my class, and so I took a liking to listening to games when the A's would play the White Sox or the Tigers, and I could pick up the game on the radio, and I heard the announcer describe Bobby's motion as he lands on the balls of his feet. He's ready to go left or right, always in position to field the ball. I would go in the backyard and with a tennis ball or a rubber ball and practice that motion. And then fast forward to 1958, my first spring training, we're going through pitcher's drills, and the pitching coach said to me, "Hey, kid, you look just like Bobby Shantz." So it's a good example of how we mimic our heroes. And, you know, if we have that picture in our mind of what our model athletes are doing from a style standpoint, we can kind of mimic that. And I did that with Bobby, and that's kind of where I got my ability to feel my position.
Let me ask you about one or two current hot-button issues in baseball. As we speak, Pete Rose is in the news again. ESPN has unearthed an old notebook showing that it looks like he did gamble as a player. What do you make of that?
Well, I feel badly for Pete. And I coach for Pete, consider myself a good friend of his. I was his pitching coach in 85, and I think what made Pete a great athlete is what has sort of brought him down from a personal standpoint. I've said to him often, if he went to a tryout camp today, he wouldn't even get a second look because he had no power, he had no range, he didn't have a strong arm, he didn't have a lot of speed, but he was a great baseball player. He had great intuitive skills, a lot of determination, and he made himself into a great baseball player. He played the game like he was bulletproof, and unfortunately he lived his life like that, and he broke some rules that caught up with him. And I had pleaded with him years ago when I interviewed him before I even went on camera that if he did have an issue and he would have just kind of admitted it and said, "Hey, I made a mistake," like we all do. I think the baseball fans and the people that make decisions about the Hall of Fame and things like that would have forgiven him. But I think this fact that he denied it for so long, I think that he just kind of burned a lot of bridges from that standpoint, and I think because of that, he's probably going to have a hard time getting reinstated.
One interesting part of the book is when you write about your relationship with Alex Rodriguez. What do you make of the year he's been having so far after being, you know, out of the sport for a year?
Oh, I think it's terrific, and I think it's a good. There's some good insight into there for all athletes and people to learn. I had a nice brief chat with Alex before I did the game last week, where he got his 3,000th hit, that home run. And the book talks about how we had a little bit of a conflict there his first year in New York. But I think when Alex first came to New York, he was, I think, trying to impress people with how good he was, and he was going to be better than Derek Jeter in terms of what he meant to the team, and maybe a bigger name than Derek, and that backfired on him. And I think now with all he's been through and coming back, getting reinstated, he's playing the game with a lot more joy. He's more relaxed. He's more grateful for what baseball has meant to him. And it shows in his performance. You know, he struck out three times against Dallas Keuchel. And he was very open about saying, man, this guy made me look silly. You know, he struck me out a fastball, changeup, a slider. He's very honest about his times that he fails, and he enjoys the times of success. And I know he wishes that he could have gone back to his first year as a Yankee and played with the same relaxed attitude and enthusiasm and sort of a gracious, humble attitude that he's exhibiting right now.
I know you're there sometimes with MLB Network, but do you miss going to Yankee Stadium every day?
Well, you know, I never took it for granted that I was just going to Yankee Stadium every day. I think you have to be very grateful for being able to follow a franchise like the Yankees and go to a historic place like Yankee Stadium. But that being said, what I really miss is the Yankee Stadium that I broke in back in 1960, what would be the original Yankee Stadium. I miss the speakers in the outfield. I miss the 457 and the 461 feet out in center and left center. You know, it kind of saddens me to see pop flies going over the wall in right mm-hmm. center field from a baseball standpoint. So that part of it is disappointing, but I think for the fans and the sort of the mystique of when you say to somebody, have you ever been to Yankee Stadium? And they never have. And when you go for the first time, all the history there, I think that's what's really so compelling and enjoyable. But I do wish that the new stadium was more of a throwback like the one that I broke in 1960.
Well, speaking for Yankee fans in this area, I have to say we miss you on Yes Network. So all the best to you, Jim Cott. He's the author of If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Yankees, Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. If you'll permit me, I'll just say, Kitty, thank you so much for your time.
All right, Ian, thanks so much. I really enjoyed this. Thanks.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.